Are you an accredited investor looking for a new opportunity to generate passive income and build the retirement of your dreams? Then elevate your investment game with Viking Capital, where wealth meets wisdom. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting out, Viking Capital can help guide you towards financial freedom through passive real estate investing. With strong and transparent underwriting, Viking identifies low-risk opportunities with the goal of preserving investor capital and maximizing long-term growth potential. And their accessible and responsive investor relations team will help you understand how each investment will impact your unique financial goals. With $800 million in assets acquired, more than $230 million in equity raised, and more than 5,000 units under management, Viking Capital is your path to early retirement. To learn about Viking Capital's latest investment opportunity, which is available for you right now, visit go.vikingcapllc.com/best. That's go.vikingcapllc.com/best to get started today. Did you know that within a decade, women will hold $30 trillion in investable assets? Yet somehow, only 19% of women reported feeling confident in selecting investments that align with their long-term goals. Our friends at InvestHer are out to change that. InvestHerCon is the number one premier conference for women in real estate, and it's happening June 2nd through the 4th in Austin, Texas. InvestHerCon is not just another real estate conference. It's a transformational experience focused on real estate investing, business strategies, and self-care tactics, all designed to help women take control of their financial futures. Gain the knowledge and skills you need to grow your portfolio and build a sustainable business, all while connecting with over 500 women who are playing at the same level. To learn more and to get your tickets, visit InvestHerCon.com today and use the code 100BESTEVER to get $100 off your ticket. That's InvestHer, HERCon.com, promo code 100BESTEVER to get $100 off your ticket. Quick disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities or to make or consider any investment or course of action. For more information, go to bestevershow.com.
Don't take the risk when the market's on its way down in terms of a lot of things, because as you build your real estate portfolio, you are building your resume for banks. If you don't make it on your first one or your second one and have hiccups, a lot of banks are not going to be willing to invest in you as the borrower later.
Welcome to the Best Ever Show, the world's longest running daily commercial real estate podcast. Our hosts interview commercial real estate experts every day to get you the best advice ever with none of the fluffy stuff.
Hello, Best Ever listeners. Welcome to the Best Real Estate Investing Advice Ever Show. I'm Ash Patel, and I'm with today's guest, Kurt Weil. Kurt is joining us from Cincinnati, Ohio. He is the president of Incline Commercial, where he has a strong background of providing individuals and businesses with superior loan products. Kurt's portfolio consists of multifamily, industrial, flex mortgages in Ohio. Kurt, thank you so much for joining us, and how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
It's our pleasure. Kurt is also a good friend of mine, and I've known him for a number of years. I've worked with him, and I'm excited for today's conversation. Kurt, if you would, before we get started, can you give the Best Ever listeners a little bit more about your background and what you're focused on now?
Sure. As you said, I'm the president of Incline Commercial. So my day job is providing commercial loan products to clientele, anywhere from commercial mortgages, multifamily, industrial, kind of the whole bit, to SBA business loans, things of that nature. Personally, like you said, I'm an investor. I have my own portfolio that I self-manage and then also invest in deals with a group of friends and business associates.
Kurt, I'm going to be honest with you. I was always against using lending brokers. In my mastermind, I've taught people, build relationships with local lenders. Do not use lending brokers and do not use lenders as commodities. We see this a lot in the multifamily world because those loans are commoditized, right? They're fairly easy to shop around, and there's a secondary market for those loans. With what I do in non-residential commercial real estate, often these loans, there's no secondary market, meaning whichever bank originates the loan, they hold it for the life of the loan. And because we do value add deals, these are not very appealing to most lenders. They have high vacancy, maybe high CapEx. So we really relied on those lending relationships to get some of our deals done. The climate's changed today, and I am now a huge advocate of using lending brokers, because a lot of the lenders that we've used in the past, their lending environment, their lending appetite is changing week by week. What are you seeing with lenders today?
A couple different things. You've kind of hit the spot on a lot of different items of what's being done out there now differently and what's changed. I would agree that the relationship is very important, specifically in a space that you're in, where you're taking something that on paper today, it doesn't look good. In banks, they don't like risk. They don't want risk, but they do want risk, right? They have to invest in risk to be able to make a return and make the bank profitable. So the least amount of risk they could take is the most advantageous. And typically that's getting a project and booking a project day one that cash flows. Now, with a high vacancy or a high CapEx, if the rents in place are low or very vacant property like you buy, it's not showing today. So then they're going back to the guarantor, the person behind it. And do they have the wherewithal? If he doesn't get this occupied, can he still repay the loan? Can he still meet those obligations? And that is where the relationship comes in. I know Ash. I've dealt with him for 20 years. I've taken projects that had no cash flow for millions of dollars, and he made it work in a year. And that is very important to have that relationship, because that guy going into that specific lender, whether it be a broker, me going to the bank, or the banker itself going to their board and saying that exact thing, goes a long way in getting that approval for the loan. And I think probably now more than ever, with the turbulent time that we're in, and I say turbulent because banks don't know what they want. It's very hard to know what you want when a lot of them are strapped liquidity-wise. And when they're strapped liquidity-wise and they spent the last couple of years booking 3-4% loans, and now with the limited amount of resources of capital that they have, what do they do with that? Do they want to do an hospitality loan? Because it's great, but if you're rate shopping them, they're going to say, look, I have to be here because I only have so much limited capital left. I have to offset all the lower rates that I did previously to even out my interest income. The same way that we as investors look at our portfolio of what's our cash on cash return, whatever you look at, the bank says, okay, well, I have $400 million out in loans. My average interest rate is 5%. It takes me 1.5-2% to keep the lights on, all encumbered. I'm borrowing at this rate, or I'm giving out CD deposits at 3%. That spread is their interest income. That's what they're making as an investor themselves. So that's the point where we're at right now, is when you have limited capital, they're being more selective on either the deal they're doing that they want a home run because they don't want a delinquency or something to go bad, or they're going to make sure that they get the higher rate to offset anything that they have left to use or deploy.
Why do banks have limited capital now? I would think with the high interest they're paying on savings, everyone's putting their money into the bank.
Yes and no. There's a lot of factors that go into it. One factor to remember, which a lot of people don't know, and maybe I know this more from my previous past of working inside banks, there's a loan loss reserve. Every time you book a loan, there's a risk rating associated with each loan. And for you, for example, your particular lender that you have a relationship with may say, given our underwriting matrix, he scores out at a 10 scale of 2. And 1 through 4 is passable. We're going to give you a loan. 2 is very, very good. 1's essentially cash secured. 2 is like, okay, we can reserve a lot less. You do a $1 million loan, they're reserving maybe 1-2 cents on the dollar in reserves. It's called a loan loss reserve. So for any loans that go bad, they're supposed to be reserving for that. So part of the liquidity is going to that as well and sitting on their balance sheet. Along with that, though, over the good years that we've had, you have to think about, okay, well, we just did our 15th loan with Asha. He's got $100 million out with us. Then they may say, okay, well, if any of that goes bad, that's a domino effect. And banks have had this happen with some bigger clientele that they had, where they may be at their maximum lending limit with one client, they may have to reserve more at the recommendation of their auditors, because if that one were to go bad, that's a way bigger hit than just a one-off like $1 million loan here or there.
Kurt, a lot of the larger syndicators always use lending brokers to find the absolute best deals. Why is it that they don't just go back to the same lender and try to get the best deal there?
I think with that, there's probably multiple factors. I would probably give you some examples that I run into personally when I work with syndicators. One is it may be a larger deal and I may line it up with a smaller lender like a credit union or a community bank in that particular area. And when I do that, they may only be able to do that one loan. That may be the max that they'll do on. And they may be very agile and very awesome with the rates and terms, flexible, if you will, that's all we can get done because we filled their box. It may be a footprint issue. For example, I could do a loan for you here in Cincinnati with a lender. Same lender we can go do in Indiana. Same lender we can go do Kentucky. You get down to Atlanta, they don't follow that footprint. So then we have to use a different lender. Logistics and size is typically what it comes down to. And again, it may become seasoning. Seasoning starting to become something more. This kind of goes back to your other question as well of what are we seeing changes in now? If it's a newer relationship, it comes down to, okay, we just closed last week a 5-unit strip center where there's 2 tenants. It's not even 1-to-1. You're going to put $500,000 into it. If I go to them next week and bring them another deal with the same guy like you, if I just did that for you, and then you come back next week and do it again, they're going to say, well, let's see what he does with this one. It's a new relationship. We got to see how it works. I want to see his operations. I want to see, does he do what he say he can do? That, I think, is becoming more and more important, whereas the last few years have been so good that, yeah, let's take a shot. Yeah, let's keep doing it. This time, more so the higher ups are all saying, hey, let's slow it down. Let's take it step by step. Let's not push someone into overgrowth, if you will. A lot more of that. How much debt have they accumulated over the past 12, 24 months? How many of these projects are not stabilized? These are questions that are being asked more rather than they were less over the past few years. So I think from a lending standpoint, there's a lot of different questions being asked, which leads to the differences that you see for someone like in my place, for example, where I'm like, that lender was great, but on this one, I have an idea. Let's go with this one. Here's why. The last lender, I filled his box. He doesn't have any more money to lend. If he does, he's borrowing at the overnight rate. If he does that, you're going to have a higher rate, et cetera, et cetera.
I have a great example to illustrate exactly what you said. So we are in January of 2024. We had a lender that we were building a lot of traction with down south, and we did a number of great deals with them. And all of a sudden, we bring them another, what should have been run-of-the-mill deal. It was cash flowing on day one, great potential. They should have loved it. And they kind of ghosted us. When we pushed, they said, well, we want our relationship to be a little bit more seasoned. And we were blown away because a few months prior, they were calling us hungry for more deals, asking, what else can we bring them? Is there anything we could bring to them to refi? And now all of a sudden that relationship's gone cold and they want us to be seasoned. And we were like, are you kidding me? Everything that we've done with you is cash flowing great. We've turned these properties around. And that blew us away. And it was one of the reasons it reinforced my opinion of using lending brokers in the future, because we were very loyal to them. We didn't rate shop our loans. We wanted to build a relationship. And now all of a sudden, it's like they're breaking up with us.
Yeah, it's interesting how that works because it's very one-sided, not just in those terms, but if they say, oh yeah, we would have done that, and you go somewhere else, it's like a bad breakup. They throw a little fit and they don't like it, you know? It's like you cheated on them. But then when they say, yeah, we can't do it, they're expecting you to 100% understand and say, I'm still going to call you. Our box will open back up. Maybe we'll do business again next year. Kind of with the timeline that you just spoke about, it's interesting because I had a particular lender calling me October of last year. And it's one that I did a little bit of business with, not a lot, but it's like, we're in fourth quarter. I had a good year. If I do $5 million more, I hit a bonus. So he's like, hey, send me $5 million. And it's like, now you want it because you're incentivized. So banks all have different criteria of when they're in the game, when they're not in the game, what space they're in, what space they're not in. And with what you said, I was waiting for the one big piece that is, we want to wait and see it develop the relationship. I thought they were going to start saying, hey, we want more deposit accounts. because that seems to be a big thing now, is when you're getting past maybe the initial deal or second deal, and they're like, you want us to give you another commercial real estate loan. We want a bigger depository account, or we want all operating checking accounts. They're starting to ask for things where they feel very justified. And in some instances, logistically, it just doesn't work, which again is back to your other question about why do brokers use different banks? Again, that is becoming a big reason why we're using different banks for particular clients, even syndicators, because certain restrictions or certain conditions or covenants, as you'll call them, where they're requiring certain type of depository accounts or something. And I have one instance locally where it's taking an 80% LTV down to essentially 70. And I just go back to that particular lender and say, no, my client would rather put 10% down than make 5% in the money market when you're giving them 7 on the loan. I'm sitting there thinking in my head, well, we'll just wait a year or two when that's done, and then we'll go refinance it somewhere else without a depository relationship. But again, another point in case, if you will.
That lender in particular did that, I think, on our second or third deal. They asked us for a deposit account. They didn't ask for a specific dollar amount, but we opened a couple zero interest checking accounts just to throw them a bone. But it was a subsequent deal that they wanted us to, what do they call it, season the relationship. So I am going to pull my money back out of that lender and put it somewhere else, because it's sitting there idle doing them a favor. And it was a very cold explanation. It wasn't, look, this got handed down from above, you know, I would go to bat for you. It was just cold. Like, we wanted to season more, and that was it.
Yeah. And I run into that as well. And I think that it's interesting, because some of the more seasoned LOs, as we'll call them, loan officers inside banks, if you're working with a really good one, they probably started out at a larger institution where they started out in underwriting, like I did. And when you start out in underwriting, you learn the metrics of a deal. You learn the 5 C's of credit. You pass the sniff test. You know if this thing's going to get approved or not, barring third party or background checks that you don't do up front. You do when you solidify the deal with the client and start going through. But you know, cash flow works, global works, they have the liquidity, the collateral's good, it's something the bank wants. And what happened, I think, over the last few years, a lot of banks have been just adding loan officers and loan officers and loan officers, and they're not the seasoned guys that have that background. And sometimes they can't even explain why they don't want the deal or why they're denying it, whether it's the higher ups not giving them a good answer, or they don't understand the certain metrics that maybe don't fit inside the box that they had at that standard time. So it's interesting, but you can talk. I think you can. You have the acumen in terms of business banking, commercial real estate. We've had enough conversations offline that you can pick out the guy probably in a 5-minute conversation initially, if he's experienced or not, and if you trust him, if he's going to get it done or not. The same way that when I go to these banks, a lot of the banks that I work with are people that I've worked with before in my previous life. And you know, I was some guy's underwriter at one point. You kind of know if they have it or not, especially by the explanations they give.
This guy in particular was high up, just a few levels below the president, but that was a good lesson for me to learn. You alluded to the 5 C's of lending. What is that?
The 5 C's of credit are pretty much the basics of every commercial loan that's looked at. And those 5 C's is, for example, the first and most important. Everybody hears this, right? Investors, bankers, everybody. Cash flow is king, right? So subject property cash flow is number one. Number two is global cash flow. Anybody that owns a piece of it, they're looking globally at them personally. Do these people cash flow? Do they have a secondary source of income? W-2, other real estate, some type of source, an investment account, whatever it may be. Those are the two main ones. So in the world of banking, when I referenced before, like that loan loss reserve, that they have a risk matrix and every deal is risk rated of how risky or not risky they assume the deal to be. That matrix is based upon the 5 C's of credit. So they're taking that individual property cash flow, global cash flow, credit worthiness, such as like personal credit, or if it's a true operating commercial business, there's a DMV report, Duns & Bradstreet, which tracks the pay history just like it would for an individual on a credit report. There's also the collateral itself. Usually that's based on LTV. And then there's a capacity. Capacity is what's the liquidity? How many months in reserves globally? can this project, along with all the global debts, there's some banks that calculate different, how many months reserves could they service all the debt globally? And if it's, okay, well, this guy only has 9 months, that make it a higher rating. When I say higher, like a 4 or 5 or something, right? Whereas subject cash flow on this thing, day one's 2.0, that's going to get a 1. And all of it is weighted. And each bank rate, their ratings are weighted differently. So you essentially fill out this matrix and then you get an overall score. And it may not necessarily be a number. It may be moderate high. Every bank risk rates differently, but typically it's a number system. And then it goes from when you essentially you book it, you're like, on a, if it's a typical 8 or 10 scale, 1 through 4, 1 through 5 is passable. They're going to book the loan. You're portfolioed, you start missing payments, things like that. You're going from the 5 to 8. You're going to loss mitigation, SAG, special assets group. You're getting problem loan asset reports. It gets into the bad stuff, which could lead into what we see here later in 24, early 25, with the way some things people are paid for that were overbooked. And I just read a stat actually in the commercial world that 57% of loans that were booked between 2020 and 2022 could not service the debt in place if the rates were to go to today's rates. So again, kind of that risk rating matrix becomes a big thing, which goes back to the 5 C's of credit. And that's kind of the basis of all underwriting inside banks and how they look at you as a client.
Kurt, let's demystify what it is that you do. Years ago, I thought lending brokers were no different than a Rocket Mortgage or Quicken Loans, where you submit your deal, your financials, and a whole bunch of different banks automatically bid on it. And it's all automated, kind of like a stock trade. But that's not really the case. Explain to us what it is that you do. If I have a deal and I say, Kurt, I need a loan. It's a hairy deal. Can you walk us through the process of what a lending broker should do?
Sure. My process, and this is just me. I don't know if there's an industry standard. I know a lot of brokers just say, yeah, send me your financials. Here's a list. Give me all this stuff. Just give it to me. And they'll put it in a folder and they'll send it to a bank. Say, can you do this? And they throw and see if it sticks. My particular process, I kind of followed the process that I would do at the bank. The loan officer brings in the deal, collects all the financials, stacks it nice and neatly. Then they give it to the underwriter to look at. And the underwriter will go and start running the 5 C's of credit. You're looking at the property. You're doing the cash flow. You're going to do it global. You're looking at the liquidity reserves post down payment. You're looking at the collateral itself. And then you're also looking at character. They always joke, character is the hardest thing to underwrite. Again, that's where that LO that says, I worked with Hospitel for 22 years. He's never defaulted on a loan. That's where that comes in, which again, goes into experience. If you have experience doing this, if this is your first time ever even rehabbing a deal, they get nervous. So you look at all that. And that's what I do. When I get a package in, I say, let me know when you uploaded everything to my secure link. I'll go in and underwrite it. And then based on my underwriting, it's like, we have a few problems because of the lack of occupancy. I need all these leases, or I need this, this, or this, or do you have any LOs out right now? So I can say, this is 25% occupied, but there's 3 LOs out right now that will put it at 55. This is going to give more validity to the pro forma. It's more so upfront, I'm painting the picture, but then I'm also trying to mitigate any weaknesses that the bank is going to find and address them up front. Because a lot of times people may not know this because this is getting into the weeds of it, but that's what I feel like my job is. My job is to get in the weeds and then interpret what is there and what it's going to be and make sure the bank understands that. Because if the bank goes on the back end and finds out, we're in underwriting, we almost have this to approval, we're going to board, but we just found out this guy has a judgment or this property has another lien. Is there a third mortgage on this that we don't know about? And that's the kind of things that you have to get in front of. And when you bring it all in front, it makes them more comfortable. He told us everything we knew about this. But when they find something, they almost look at it as like an aha moment. Gotcha. You're trying to pull one over on me. So just kind of taking any of those weaknesses, mitigating them, and just putting it all up front. And I share my underwriting with the bank, all my calculations. I do a summary, which is called the lender's analysis. And again, you're hitting with the words, the 5 C's of credit, and then putting all the stats in there that you calculated, and then backing it up with your stat sheet, or as we call spreads. And then you're telling the bank, take a look at this. this fits your box. I know that you like multifamily. I know you go up to 90% on a rehab loan of total project cost. This is an experienced client. As I underwrite, I start to see of my lender group, this would be a good fit for this banker. This would be a good fit. This is what the client wants. And try and find the best mix of what's the best deal for the client and what bank do I know will approve this. I meet both boxes or get as close as possible.
One of the things I'm hearing is when you qualify a loan broker, it would be ideal to find somebody that came from the banking environment and ideally that was an underwriter at some point in their career.
I'm biased towards that because that's what's worked for me. Yes, ideally, if I was to hire someone within my business, that's what I would be looking for. It's very hard to find somebody who did the analytics that was an underwriter and then also be able to go out and sell and have the personality of a loan officer. So you have very different type of dynamics. The stereotypical number cruncher. If you've ever heard a loan officer or someone at the bank say, oh, my underwriter won't approve this, but then you can't get the underwriter on the phone because, oh, they don't want to talk to you. So if you can find someone that has the mix and really knows the bucket, I call it the bucket, what exactly their bank wants, and I'll have some lenders, hey, we love this deal, let's do it. But to get an approval, Kurt, I know I'm going to need this. My board's going to want this to be able to get it approved. It's great. I love working more with those loan officers. And not all of them were probably necessarily underwriters at one point, but most of the ones that do that have been there long enough to know the personalities involved in the approval process, which I think is a big piece of it as well. So not necessarily, but sure, that's my preference because I have a bias.
What do lenders think of you loan brokers? Are you a necessary evil? Are you dipping into their potential fee structure, commissions, or are you truly cohesive and they enjoy working with loan brokers?
It varies. And again, just like you have a life cycle as an investor, you're young, you're hungry, you don't have anything, you're going after it all. Some banks that never did commercial lending or never really did or never really had the expertise on staff to do it that are starting up, they may be more hungry and have to put it on their books because there's better spreads than car loans, home loans, things like that. And they may look at you as a necessary evil where they'll use you, abuse you, and stack their books and lend out all their money and then be done with you and say, thanks, we're done with brokers. There's some lenders locally that have done that. And then they want to go back and contact your book of business that you brought them. There's some that I've worked with for years that just have a cohesive relationship that say, Kurt, I'm not going to call your clients. They don't mind lowering their origination fee or their fees to provide me to charge. So it's no different if the client walked in the door by himself or with me. The difference is with me, I know if they're juicing the rate or if their spread's higher or call out, this is kind of the deal that we have. Don't give them the front door deal and juice everything up. So it's a mix.
We'll get back to the show with first some sponsors I'm confident you'll find value in learning more about. A 1031 exchange is one of the greatest tools to build your real estate portfolio. But before you sell your next investment property, if you want to save thousands in capital gains taxes, please give our friends at 1031 Pros a call. Whether you're an individual investor, title company, or real estate agent, 1031 Pros is ready to help you or your clients with their 1031 exchange needs. With over 30 years of experience, 1031 Pros specializes in various types of exchanges like delayed, simultaneous, reverse, and improvement exchanges in all 50 states, all while ensuring your transaction is fast, reliable, transparent, and secure. 1031 Pros has handled over 20,000 audit-free exchanges, and right now, best ever listeners can get $250 off any exchange by visiting my1031pros.com/best ever. That's my1031pros.com/best ever to get $250 off today. Have you heard that Mint, the popular personal finance app, is shutting down? If you use Mint, that's bad news. The good news is that there's an even better alternative, Monarch Money. Monarch gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. Create custom budgets, set goals, and collaborate with others. And now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/best ever. Most personal finance apps are clunky and cluttered with ads. Monarch is different. Its intuitive design makes setup, customization, and everyday use simple and easy. Monarch is also the most customizable budgeting app available. You can change your dashboard layout, create custom budgets and notifications, and even invite your partner, accountant, or financial advisor to have a joint view of your finances at no extra cost. Once you try Monarch for yourself, you'll understand why it was named 2024's best budgeting app by the Wall Street Journal. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/best ever. That's monarchmoney.com/best ever for your extended 30-day free trial.
Let's dive into that. In terms of owning a relationship, if I use you as a lending broker and you introduce me to a bank that I never would have found on my own, it's in a different state, local lender, you got the loan done. Now, next time I've already got this relationship with this bank, why do I go through you? Why should the lender pay your fees? Can I just go directly to that lender next time?
You can. As a broker, I like to think that I bring value to you as the investor, that there's banking things that I know that you don't know. And as you go through that process, there's probably a lot of things that I negotiate throughout the process that you don't know that I do either, whether it be specific third-party work order, specific language not written into the loan agreement, waiving potential covenants that they may come up with, depository relationships, if I'm negotiating those, escrows. And again, just overall structure, term, rate, IO period, all those kind of things. Prepayment penalties are a big one that we're negotiating. So it really, I think, comes down to negotiations and having that advisory role. If you go around the second time, the bank goes, I don't know, Ash, cash flow is tight on the last one. It's going to be tight on this one. I can do it, but I'm going to do it at a higher rate. Where, well, if I underwrote the second one, I'm like, it wasn't tight last time. And this one's not tight either. No, we're going to want the same rate or else we'll go somewhere else. So the power of leverage too, knowing that I can take it somewhere else and get it done, and they know that too, can change a lot of things. In terms of the fees, you're going to pay the same regardless if you use me or not. In terms of bank fees.
Yeah, what is your fee typically? What am I paying for these services?
Typically, I've been told to raise numerous times, but I'm cheap. I'm 0.5%. Typical broker structure is they get 1% no matter what. I don't do that. I believe majority of the lenders that I work with, they lower their originations to leave room for me to charge if they don't pay me, which most of them got away from that model of paying the broker direct because they don't have any money to pay people direct right now. So what happens is they lower the fees that they would charge you directly, and then I charge, based on my agreement, the difference. And it keeps it under 1% of the total loan amount. A lot of brokers, if you get them on the phone right now, they'll say, I charge 1% no matter what the bank charges. Sign my agreement, and we can start the process. Mine is, send me your stuff. I'm telling you right now, I'm 0.5 up front, but I don't get my agreement signed until I actually bring you a deal, and you say, yeah, I like that, let's do it. Because I feel like there's got to be some type of performance for payment.
Okay, are you saying that there are certain brokers that you give them the 1% up front, even if they don't secure the deal?
They will make you sign their agreement up front to exclusively go through them. But if they ask you for some of that fee up front, I never agreed with that and I wouldn't. It's only at the time of commitment. If a bank issues a commitment with the loan approved, are they allowed to ask for it? But typically it's collected. It's put on the closing statement and it's collected by the title company as part of the closing. If they're asking for you it up front, I'm not a fan of that. And I haven't seen that work out well for people.
So there's lending brokers out there that want to own an exclusive relationship. So if I engage with that lending broker, but I find my own lender come, I still owe them that fee. Is that how those are written?
It depends how they're written. They're written many different ways, but a lot of times you'll owe them at least something for their time. They want you to sign their broker agreement up front because they want you to exclusively go through them because essentially they're shopping for you. Now, if I bring you a term sheet that says it's a good lender, let's go with this. That's when I make you sign mine and say, stop shopping. Let's go. Because if you shop it and try to get down the road with someone else, but we're going through the actual approval process, you can really screw the deal up. And I've had a particular case where that happened and the banks call me saying, hey, we just pulled his credit. Why did such and such bank just pull his credit yesterday? And I'm like, I don't know. And he goes, oh, well, I thought I would get approved by your bank and this other bank in case if one of them didn't work out. And I'm like, one of these banks might pull out now. And this was a time we were busy.
We had a commercial broker down south that made an introduction to a lender, and we ended up using that lender. Unbeknownst to us, this person was also a loan broker. So he was a commercial real estate broker and a loan broker. And just making that introduction, he ended up charging us fees on that loan. What we didn't know was the three or four subsequent loans that we did with that lender, this broker came back and said, I made the introduction, so I own that relationship. You owe me commission on all of these deals that you've done. And we were blown away that people would operate in that manner. Obviously, we were not on board with that. The lender thought it was silly and it didn't fly. But that was a pretty bold thing he tried to do. Is that common where brokers will try to permanently own a relationship between a borrower and a lender?
It can be, yeah. It sounds like he had some type of clawback in his broker agreement. If you sign one, a clawback period is a time of period of, I introduce you to this lender, say it's Navy Federal Credit Union. You never use them. I have a relationship. I placed this deal with them. You would have never found them without me. If you do any subsequent deal with them from the time this loan closes up to like the next 12, 18, typically I think it's like 2 years, they'll say you need to go through me to cultivate that relationship. And that is relatively common. In my agreement, I have a clawback for 12 months on the specific property and only the specific property I just financed. If you turn around and want to do something with the same property I just placed with the bank in less than 12 months, you didn't even give them a chance to make interest income for all the work they did up front. So it's kind of a net loss for them. That's kind of why I put it in there. I always ask, like, keep it for 12 months, even if I'm not getting paid on the deal, because my banking relationships are as important as my client relationships. It works both ways. With that being said, I wouldn't go after anyone, but I would be not wanting to work with them again because I would expect them to come back to me and want to use my expertise.
Yeah, it's a good way to burn lending relationships also. If you are planning on holding something for a quick flip under a year, by all means, be honest with the lender and let them know that. But if you're going in there telling them, oh yeah, I'm a long-term buy and hold, I'm going to keep this and gift it to my grandkids, and you flip it in 6 months, you ruined your integrity and the future of that relationship.
Yes. I've been caught on deals like that before where the borrower didn't tell me during that time, like, hey, I sold this. And they did. And the bank's like, hey, we just got to pay off for this. We just did this like 6 months ago with you. What the heck? So I've been in those situations before. And one of them was actually a good client of mine that I've done like 7 or 8 deals with. And he's like, dude, I literally got the screw you price. Like somebody gave me a price. Screw it. I got to take it. Right. And I told the lender, I'm like, dude, he's 6 months. This guy's making like $3 million on a $3 million purchase. He doubled his money. And it's like, he didn't do much. I'm like, he didn't even have to finish his reno money loan. And they're like, okay, well, we don't like it, but he's got to obviously 1031, bring us the next deal. So that's kind of the other thing. It's like, all right, good borrower. He just got a bunch more capital. He can get into a better LTV position on a new property and we can book a bigger loan. So there is some offset with that. And that's the ideal case. Now, again, example between 20 and 22, right? Where things were really good, but you can offset those things. But yeah, just like you said, be totally honest. And there's some that did that before. And I'm like, dude, why didn't you just tell me? We would have set this up as a short-term note. Why did you go and try and do like, oh, I want a 10-year fixed? It's like, you know, and they really played the game like, oh, I knew I was always flipping this. And it's like, well, we probably would have went to a different lender with no prepay, but whatever. But yeah, that chaps bankers as well. Yes. Again, that's one of the 5 C's. It goes back to one of the 5 C's, character. You can't underwrite character. Those are character issues.
Kurt, one of the things that I'm an advocate of now today, because I've heard so many people on social media, friends of mine, people in my network, where the lender pulls the deal just before the closing. They got cold feet, whatever. And these are lenders that people have established relationships with. And all of a sudden, maybe one of the higher ups said, okay, we're freezing lending, or we're not doing this deal, whatever it may be. But great deals, incredible deals are getting pulled at the last minute. I am an advocate of always having 2 lenders ready to go. If I use you as a lending broker, are you able to, in good faith, have 2 lenders on the hook pretty much all the way through?
To an extent, yes. There's at some point where you stop the process with your backup. If you know what your backup's going to do, if you know that they would do the deal and you know what terms they're offering, like we got a good backup if this one pulls the plug. Again, to be honest with you, in 2023, I only had that happen to one deal with one lender. And it was a lender where the higher ups go, no, we're not doing that. Even though I've had very seasoned people that work there that I've worked with for a very long time, like, yeah, we love this deal. Let's do it. When you get to the point, like that final approval process, that's where you kind of got to pull the plug. You can't have the other bank go and pull their credit a couple weeks after you've already been through underwriting with this lender or whatnot. You make sure if you're going with the foremost lender that you're scared is going to pull the plug, you still let them order all the third party work, let it get it assigned to them, kind of that whole process. You just have to know that if you got a backup lender, they like the deal, you know their terms that they offered on it, and they did offer on it, and it's like, okay, this is subject to like final underwriting. I went back to them and said, you guys are up. The other bank pulled out. Why? Well, they pulled out because the higher up said they're not in that sector anymore. Okay, fine. Let's take your terms. You guys can go ahead and pull credit now. We accept the terms. I'm going to send you the appraisal environmental, and you guys will get the appraiser and the environmental company online and have the reports signed over to you. So there's the back work to do, but again, with your backup, you can only go so far. But yes, personally, I do keep backups in my back pocket just in case if that happens. But again, I've had it rarely happen. Like I said, last year, it only happened one time. And I could see it happening more now as time goes on, especially with the change in the market. So I'm a lot more cognizant of it. But yes, if that makes sense, I guess the point that I'm trying to get across is there's only a certain point that you want to go to with it. If you want to go full-blown approval with two banks at the same time, that's tough because you don't really want to screw up or give the first bank a reason to say no.
Understood. Yeah. Really what I was after was having a lender on standby that is intimately aware of the details of the deal and are ready to go pending a few final checks. So, okay, good to know that.
Yes.
We talked about lending appetites changing week by week. And you mentioned some of the newer lenders are hungrier. How do you keep up with the lending appetite of each of these lenders?
A massive Excel sheet. I have my list of lenders. Some will send you rate sheets. Some will only by phone call say, this is kind of where we're pricing things today. It's different all over. And then when you call them or talk to them, I'm on the phone a lot, probably with lenders, maybe more than I am clients, especially now. Is there anything you guys aren't doing? Is there anything new you guys are doing? Do you have a new program? A lot of banks are like, we want owner-occupied business. You know, they'll tell you what they want. They'll tell you what they're going after. If you have it, you know, that kind of thing. So kind of putting those details with each bank. Every lender I have, it's what's your minimum loan amount that you'll accept? What's the maximum you can do? Where are you priced at today? Are you 1.5%, 2%, 3% over the five-year treasury? Are you bracing on prime for draw notes? Do you do lines of credit? Do you not? Kind of that whole gamut of what do you do? What are your parameters? And then what specific property types? Because the bulk of my business is investment real estate. So it's what real estate asset classes are you after and what are you not after? And keeping the details with each one is what I track specifically. Like I said, when I'm underwriting a deal, I'm thinking in my head, okay, this apartment, okay, this is this LTV. They need this rate to make it work. Oh, it's syndicated. They don't want anybody 20% or less to sign. Okay, we should go to this lender and this lender. These two will take that. The other ones won't because they want everybody to sign. So it's kind of all those factors of understanding the nitty gritty is what I detail and track because it's important. Too many times do you get, oh, I sent X National Bank. I won't say that name. I've had so many people go, well, yeah, I sent to them. They said they could do it. And then all of a sudden, no, my underwriter looked at it. It's just not in our wheelhouse. And it's like, well, that was 2 weeks. You just wasted 2 weeks on a purchase contract. You're killing me. So I like to have that vetted out front because if you know they're not going to take it or it's not in their appetite, there's no point in even wasting the time.
Kurt, is there a deal that's too small for you? So let's take a $300,000 mixed-use building. It's not residential, it's commercial. And you're only getting a half point on the deal, but you're putting in essentially the same amount of work. Is there a minimum threshold to have you do a deal?
I've been trying to give a minimum standard for years. I'm not going to do anything under 250. That usually seems to be about the mark. To me, it's not so much about the deal size. specifically if it's a repeat client and it's like, hey, I found this small deal, but man, I just can't pass it up. It's a good deal. Okay. I already have your global. I've already underwritten you. I have a lot of your financials. Like, it's not as much more work for me. So yeah, of course I'll do it. To me, once a client, always a client. So I'm willing to always go the distance with you. In terms of if people are like, hey, I got the single family. I just bought it a year ago. I just rehabbed it. The 1-4s right now are like, no bank wants them. Not even as, can you do this for me based on our relationship? No, man. There's so many lenders that are just closed. It's not just me. They're just not doing 1-4s. Everybody's got their fill. They got guys walking in the bank every day. They have their own clients that have a blanket of 50 single family homes. So I would probably say more asset class wise, the 1-4s is just something I'm not really into because banks don't want them. And even my go-tos, I have to do a big favor to get them to take it on the commercial side because essentially it's because they're purchasing something that needs an entity transfer, et cetera, et cetera. But with my clients, if I did a deal for you, there's no threshold, but 250 is
that?
Is what I try.
You would think that those 1-4s are safe, easy to underwrite, little risk of foreclosure. Why is there no appetite for those?
Because they have their fill. So again, much like the bank looks at their interest income off their book portfolio, they also manage the risk. How much do we have in 1-4 residential habitation? How much do we have in office? How much do we have in hospitality? And they break down their portfolio as a percentage. And that stuff comes in all the time to an extent where everybody has more than the allotted percentage of their portfolio that they want. So again, they manage their portfolio much like an investment. They have concentrations. And if you have a concentration of more than X amount of your portfolio in this specific sector, specifically say office right now or hospitality, if you got 50% of your portfolio in office and hospitality right now, those auditors are probably going to come knocking on your door for a special audit next week. The FDIC, NCUA, ASI, the state auditors, ODFI, they all come in and audit every lending institutional every year. And your portfolio as a lender gets stress tested. Can you support rates going up? If these guys can't pay off what you booked at and had to refinance today with you, or their arm adjusts with you in 5 years based on the term, is it a balloon or is it a readjustment? And they'll stress your portfolio. They'll look at your concentrations in your portfolio. And then every bank has their own internal auditors too. They'll get a CPA firm to come in and do the same thing. So it's very important for them to manage not just portfolio size of how much they can have of a commercial portfolio, but then also concentrations in their portfolio of each specific category.
Kurt, if our best ever listeners are looking for a lending broker, how do they go about finding one? What are questions to ask?
If I was going to go find one, I would ask them their background. How long have they been in the business? And then just ask them what their process is. Because I think you'll find out very quickly. You know, I got 30 banks I work with. Just send me your financials. I'll get them out to them and we'll see what happens. To me, you didn't give me any detail. Not sure. I look more for the details. Maybe that's the analytic training in me or something, but I like when they provide more details up front. This is what I need. This is why I need it. I know lenders that are going to require 3 years of tax returns, not two, or all that kind of jazz. And I think it's very important when you have that initial conversation. Everybody gets, in my opinion, so caught up on rate. And rate, yes, I understand it's important. I'm an investor. I get it. But if you're going to sit there and say, this deal works at 7, but it doesn't work at 7.25, one, you should probably walk away. You don't even have meat on the bone. Number two, if rate is the main concern, but you don't have any other metrics to measure by, again, if, like we were talking about before, be honest, if you're going to flip. If you're going to flip it, no, I got to have a better rate. I got to have a better rate. I would rather take the lender with a 7.5% rate that has no prepayment penalty than go with the lender at 7% that has a prepayment penalty in place because you're going to end up paying more. And I think there's a lot of that people don't understand. So if you're working with a broker and you tell them your initial story, my first question as a broker, this is what I want to hear if I was going to call a broker. With this property, what's your goal? And if you say long-term appreciation, I want to put a good loan product in place. Okay, well now, as a broker, I'm thinking exactly what product you should have. We should go look for a 10-year fix, 25-year AM, cash flow the crap out of this thing. If you're like, I'm going to sell it probably in 3 to 5 years. All right, let's look at 5 and 7 year ARMs, depending on how risk averse you are, and lock something in with probably a minimal prepayment penalty of a 3-2-1. because if you're not going to sell for 3 to 5 years, prepayment drops off. So you start to size it in your head of based on this person's goal, because you don't expect every individual to know all the different types of loan products out there. So I think it's key up front to explain to the individual. They can tell you what their goal is, and then you can think in your head, okay, well, this is the product that's going to fit you best that's out there. So I think them helping guide you through that on the initial conversation is very important. So if you can find that, you probably found someone that really knows what they're talking about.
Kurt, what does it take to be a loan broker? Do you have to be licensed?
It depends. If you're going to do residential deals and book 15-year or 30-year mortgages, government-backed mortgages, you have to get what's called an NMLS license, and it's provided per state. I used to have one at my previous brokerage that I was at before I started my own brokerage, and I didn't do it because you have to be bonded when I started Incline Commercial, and I never did enough of that residential book of business. I always did commercial. In commercial, there's not as much licensing requirements. I think it's more experience-based because bankers will either work with you or not work with you, but it's not as rigid as state-regulated. Even if you're going to do a commercial loan, you still have to have a residential license in certain states.
Okay, so the reason I asked that was I wanted to see if anybody could become a commercial loan broker. And if that is the case, if the barrier to entry is minimal, it's even more important to qualify the person you're working with.
Absolutely, yeah. Technically, it's pretty minimal in terms of requirements. But again, all I can say personally is that you're either going to make it or break it up based on reputation. Reputation is everything. And you have nothing but your name and what you say you're going to do, and you have to come through. It's a service-based business.
What is your best real estate investing advice ever?
I would say right now, especially in this time, be patient. Don't jump on a deal. I shouldn't say don't jump on a deal. Don't try and make a deal work. This goes back to, I need 7%, 7.25%. That deal doesn't work for you. Don't do it. Don't take the risk when the market's on its way down in terms of a lot of things, because as you build your real estate portfolio, you are building your resume for banks. If you don't make it on your first one or your second one and have hiccups, a lot of banks are not going to be willing to invest in you as the borrower later. So be patient. Make sure you find the right deal. Even if it's a single or double, but you know it's stable, do a good deal, especially if you're starting out. A good, stable deal, and be patient and make sure you stick to the metrics you're looking for.
A total side note. On that note, we have a deal that we're working on that I was brought into at the last minute, and it's a new lender and they don't know anything about me. So I have to put together my bio for them. And we don't have a lot of time on this deal. It's a huge deal. So I can't just send them a simple bio. I had to put together a pretty lengthy deal about me, but I included a lot of historical high-profile properties that I've done and the metrics on them. So you're right. It's important to have that ready to go. And really, a lot of it was copying, pasting, but having your entire portfolio of real estate deals in a nice, easy-to-read PDF where the lender can see a picture of the property, date purchased, plan, disposition, or current status. So all the Best Ever listeners have that. Instead of a resume that you would do for your W-2, have your resume ready to go for all of your historic properties. So Kurt, thank you for sharing that. And are you ready for the Best Ever Lightning Round?
Yes.
All right, Kurt, what's the best ever book you recently read?
I'm actually reading The Encyclopedia of Commercial Real Estate by Terry Painter right now. And like me, he's a commercial loan broker. And he's more seasoned, older in age than I. He's definitely been around the block. He's a contributor to Forbes on the real estate piece. He's very well known. And I think that it's a great book. It really covers not just a lot of terminology, but real world examples. He's also an investor. I very much relate to him, so I really, really like it and suggest anybody that is looking for a book to read anything in commercial, it's going to give you more aptitude to your commercial intelligence.
Kurt, what's the best ever way you like to give back?
I think the hardest thing for me to do right now in my career is to give back time. And when I'm able to do that, I really enjoy it because it's kind of like a sacrifice, right? people always look at giving money or time and being middle-aged and building my company the way I have and still being the only employee for how long, giving my time back. So I coach high school sports on the side and then like to volunteer when I can. To me, that's a sacrifice because I know it takes a lot for me to be able to make that obligation and do it. That's how I like to give back.
And Kurt, how can the best ever listeners reach out to you?
I'm on LinkedIn. That's pretty much my only social media exposure. I think up after this, you'll have my information. You can email me or call my cell. Those are pretty much the ways to get through to me. Majority of my business has been organic. It's always from clientele, refer me out. It's all word of mouth. I don't advertise online or try and bring in millions of hits, whatnot. But those are the best ways, LinkedIn, social media wise, and then just email me or call me.
What's your email address, if you don't mind?
It's inclinecommercial@outlook.com.
Well, Kurt, thank you for your time today. It was great catching up with you. Learned a few things, and I'm glad, hopefully, we demystified lending brokers for the best ever listeners. So again, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Best ever listeners, thank you for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star review. Share this podcast with someone you think can benefit from it. Also, follow, subscribe, and have a best ever day.
Hi, best ever listeners. Joe Fairless here again. And one last thing before you go, would you like to receive a short weekly email with proven tips from experienced investors, free tools and resources, and a roundup of the week's most relevant news and best ever content? Well, if so, join the community of nearly 15,000 commercial real estate passive and active investors who receive the best ever newsletter. Just go to bestevercre.com/access. And you'll get the very next one. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, thank you for listening and have a best ever day.